Fan pregame on a Friday, draft night in the NHL. Justin Cuthbert with you for the next hour before we get you to D.A., Books, Sam Cosentino, Colby Armstrong, and our very own Ailish Forfar for live coverage of the 2025 NHL draft. To tee it up on our end, we'll have Cam Robinson in a half hour, break down the happenings. He's been really hyping up the NHL draft. He's not promised shenanigans, but he's mentioned shenanigans, so hopefully he can indulge us there. We will also get to the final fan pregame best available. I guess it's version 2.0. Curated by our producer, David Sis, though. So we'll get to that. We'll see who he has on his own big board that we are calling our own. But it is a big-time MLSE news day, as you've probably heard. It seems like it's always ahead of a long weekend. We, of course, are ahead of a long weekend. So it seems a little bit fitting. But yeah, two major orders of business today for MLSE. Number one being Masai Ujiri cut loose as president of the Toronto Raptors, the most successful sports executive in this city in my lifetime, the only one to bring a chip to the city in the last 30 years, moved on from. And number two, John Tavares, a true blue hometown discount for the former captain, 4 years, $17.52 million, which works out to a 4.38 average annual value. A big move from the Maple Leafs and an important move for Tavares because, you know, there's a lot that goes into clearly the decision here for him. But first and foremost, you know, there's the perception of this player. And if we're talking perception and we're talking this contract, clearly it definitely boosts the perception and changes the conversation around Tavares forever, I think, in this market. 4 years, $17.52 million, as I mentioned, which represents a 60% pay cut after scoring 38 goals. So you go from one of the most expensive players in the NHL to the middle class, like light lodged in the middle. You go from the penthouse to lucky to have a view of the ocean in the resort. And kudos goes out, I think, to both the Leafs and to Tavares, maybe primarily Tavares. For the Leafs, I think they wisely saw past the production, understanding that there was a need for change, go where the puck is headed, not where it is, that old trope, but just most importantly, leverage. Leverage being used finally by this organization. When it's made available, you have to use your leverage. And for the Maple Leafs, finally conducting a negotiation on their own terms. But mostly this is about John Tavares. Maybe there wasn't a decision to be made here. Maybe he was always playing in Toronto. Hockey wasn't going to happen anywhere else, and he was really backed up in the corner here with this negotiation. But assuming there were actually other options for him, he understood that, you know, $100 million plus in the career is plenty. That this didn't need to be dramatized, didn't need to be over the top, but most importantly, that he was not going to be a deterrent. And at $4.38 million, he will not be a deterrent. Masai Ujiri will not be the president of the Toronto Raptors beyond today, which is an upsetting day, I think, for a lot of Raptors fans. To discuss that and more, let's bring in Michael Grange. Grange, thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I know it's been a busy day, so we'll get to as much as we can here. But, you know, I mentioned there, you know, an upsetting day for Raptors fans. I think it's probably made worse by the rationale or the lack of rationale. Do you sense that? Like, there's a real market attachment, clearly, to Masai Ujiri, and now there's just more questions after they were supposed to be answered?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I think you have to appreciate where maybe Keith Pelley is coming from as he stands up. And look, I mean, Keith's a very well-known guy in a lot of circles, but maybe not so much with Raptors fans, given he's been in Europe running the DP World Tour for the past, say, 8 or 10 years. And so, you know, it's a big thing to come on live television and explain why someone that's significant to Raptors history, to Toronto sports history, will no longer be going forward. And, you know, you have to kind of thread a needle between A, trying to explain it, and B, you know, you trying to pay the proper respect for someone who's been so integral to this community for 13 years. And so, you know, I think what Keith, you know, what you're not going to say in that situation is some of the hard truths, right? Which is, look, this team has not been trending in a positive direction for most of the past 5 years. There's a lot of reasons for that. There are, I think, some complicated reasons for that. And I'm not here to lay them all at Masai Ujiri's feet or anyone else associated with the Raptors. I mean, the NBA is a tricky place to navigate, and sometimes the winds blow in your favor and sometimes they don't. But I think all I'm saying is, if you're Keith Pelley and this is the decision you've decided to reach for a number of reasons, among them, maybe the team's performance, that's not maybe the message you want to lead with in your first kind of public facing meeting with Raptors fans, at least, you know, via the vehicles, the media. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, a little bit. I do think performance, if that is indeed the reason, though, like, you can justify it. I mean, they win the title in 2019, and then the pandemic kind of cut short any of the afterglow, like extinguishes anything else that was left of that. But I do think it's been a little sloppy since. I think you could have went that route. I think there are actually, you know, three plausible reasonings or explanations that you could go to, and performance would be, I think, the easiest one to trumpet. The other two would be, you know, the relationships and the power or financial dynamic. And I do want to hit on those other two. Like, the relationship aspect is important because, yeah, you can be great at your job, but if it's not going well behind closed doors and the relationships are frayed, that could just be it. It could just be as simple as that. So what do we know about, like, what life was like inside those boardrooms for Masai Ujiri as these years have gone on?
Well, I think, you know, there's two versions to that. I think the Raptors as an organization functioned well. Like, I mean, it was, you know, the one of the last things Masai Ujiri got done before today was to make sure that, you know, his executive team got their extensions, Bobby Webster being the last of those. So you're kind of looking out for his people. That's the same thing he did the last time there was a major contract imbroglio regarding Masai Ujiri, is he got all his other people done first. So I think in-house, it's been fine. I think what you're probably referring to is really just the history of this last contract and as it plays out against the backdrop of a shifting landscape within MLSE. And, you know, the contract that Masai Ujiri's been on and had 1 year left on is at the time and may still be among the most lucrative in executive contracts in all of sports. I think the base compensation's been reported at 15, and I've reported at $15 million US. I think there's other elements associated with that total compensation package that are pretty significant as well. And the kind of holdout in at that point, and it was the holdout was, it needs to be stressed, was mostly about, you know, is this what we need to pay our executive at the time, was from the Rogers side of the MLSE board. And at the time, Larry Tannenbaum had the means as the team governor to kind of unilaterally sign that deal. And that was, so it was done sort of out over the objections at the time, based mostly on compensation, is what I'm told, from the Rogers side of the board. And so fast forward, we all know what's gone on, right? Rogers is shortly going to be the 75% owner of MLSE. That deal is supposed to close, I believe, early next month. And in a year's time, it will be Larry Tannenbaum who will be stepping away as per you know, the prior ownership agreement. And so in that context, you know, we're a year away from Masai Ujiri's deal being done and him having to negotiate a raise or an extension, you know, with a board that is controlled now by, you know, a party that kind of didn't necessarily want to pay him that much in the first place. And, you know, when you look at the entire landscape of what's gone on since, you know, I wouldn't say, just as Masai Ujiri was negotiating from a position of tremendous strength back in 2021, given what the Raptors had, he had led the Raptors to and through from 2013-14. You wouldn't say that based on where this team has been the last 4 or 5 years. So that's probably the broader context, you know, and I think for all people concerned, I think this is kind of been handled pretty amicably. But it's, you know, these are tough conversations. These are tough moments in the history of a franchise. And, you know, that's the situation that Keith Pelley was dealing with today.
Yeah, Keith Pelley mentioning today that these conversations or this conclusion may have been drawn about a month ago. And Masai Ujiri, you know, not having it leak out, having it announced today, says a lot about a character and that he was able to do his job for the last month. But you're right, like over 13 seasons and this much success, like you are becoming more and more compensated, likely. You're becoming more and more successful, but you're becoming more and more a part of it. And if the franchise is spinning its wheels to a certain extent and not having any success, and you're at the point where you got to have that next contract or likely on like additions to what you're currently making, like, yeah, it kind of makes sense that you could draw the conclusion, I guess, that they drew today. What was a bit surprising to me, Grange, was that the Raptors will bring on a president, because after the Leafs did made their decision with Brendan Shanahan, they're going presidentless. I just assumed this was part of that process. So why do the Raptors need that conduit and the Maple Leafs don't?
I think that's it actually speaks to I think it speaks well of Keith Pelley that he's kind of looking at this situation and assessing where his strengths lie and maybe where his weaknesses lie. And Keith Pelley can walk into any situation in the NHL and have people he knows, people that know him. He understands the nuances, the background, the history. You know, that's an environment that I think, you know, I can't put words in his mouth, but I'm sure that he would be able to navigate and add value to very easily in based on his background in Canadian sports. The NBA is different. It's not something that he would have had a tremendous amount of exposure to. And so rather than putting yourself in a situation where not only are you making a decision to move on from one of the most significant figures in franchise history, but then to go ahead and kind of double down and put yourself in a situation where, frankly, you just maybe don't have the level of background and just hands-on experience, better to kind of go, you know what, this might be a situation where there is expertise needed. There is somebody that can help me and that can help Bobby Webster, if it's not Bobby Webster as president, navigate these things. And he was very clear that it would be a basketball-only job. Like, it's not something where he's looking for somebody to come in and, you know, sell season tickets and negotiate TV deals. It's really about, you know, just making sure you have the horsepower in your front office to, you know, to get this team where it needs to go. So I think that actually was a positive out of all this, that, you know, you got to know where your strengths lie and know where your weaknesses are. And that's a sign of leadership as far as I'm concerned.
So as you mentioned, Grange, Bobby Webster will be up potentially for the president role. He will be interviewed for the position. He right now is the incumbent, and at least he will be the general manager of this team. Like, you know, looking at this group, it's always been Masai and Bobby. And I think when people are, you know, push comes to shove, or you're just, you know, just speaking off the cuff, when you're talking about Raptors decisions, you talk about Masai making those decisions. And I think that somewhat, you know, belittles Bobby Webster's role, or at least we don't understand it to its fullest extent. You probably have a better idea of Bobby Webster's strengths and weaknesses and readiness for this moment. You know, Bobby Webster's readiness to be a general manager, be running the show here for the Toronto Raptors. Why should fans be confident in that?
I mean, I think Bobby is a guy who's got a tremendous reputation across the NBA, and he's a wonderful relationship guy. He's very, very well liked. I think he's very well respected. He's, you know, and I think why the relationship with him and Masai worked so well is, you know, Bobby was kind of very kind of comfortable being in the shadows a little bit and kind of the devil in the details and making sure all the I's and T's are crossed. And Masai Ujiri was maybe, you know, as much as he loved to dig in on the scouting side of things, and, you know, he had a different layer of relationships. That's always a key thing too. You're kind of, you know, they're different ages, so they have different cohorts of influence, let's say. And also, I think Masai was just more comfortable being out front and kind of being more of a big picture and visionary type presence. And so it was a nice kind of yin and yang. And I think Bobby probably, you know, I think he has all the capability in the world to lead an NBA franchise. You know, it's clear he's going to get a chance to convince MLSE of that. I think MLSE and Rogers think very highly of him. When you go back to sort of the boardroom drama I was referring to at the top, you know, some of the thinking there was, do we actually need Masai Ujiri? Why don't we just give the job to Bobby Webster? And so, you know, I think he'll get a fair hearing. But all that said, these are big jobs. And it's one thing, it's like being an assistant coach and a head coach. Like, it's a big difference. And there was, you know, like right in the scenario we've been describing, when something went really well, you could, you know, and Bobby had his hand in it. Let's say the Kawhi Leonard trade, that's, you know, it looks really good on him. But when things go really badly, it's Masai Ujiri has to wear it. That's, you know, so when you're the president, that's no longer the luxury you have. But I think it's a good thing that Bobby Webster and the existing front office staff are going to get a chance to be considered to take this forward. But I think they owe themselves to do due diligence and see who might be out there as someone who could lead this operation.
From a legacy standpoint, Grange, I think the last few seasons will be eventually lost to history. And when you think about Masai Ujiri, you'll be thinking about the championship, the title in 2019, foreign territory for teams in this city for sure. But beyond the championship, because it was beyond the championship, frankly, for Masai, what's the most profound way that he changed the organization or the perception around the organization or the city? In what ways beyond putting together that team do you think he had the most influence?
You know, I think he created a place where a huge swath of Raptors fans could store their beliefs and store their passions and feel themselves represented in those beliefs and those passions. And I think it ties into all kinds of things, you know, related to the diversity of the city, diversity of the country, the way those things have changed. I think the way there was a hunger in, you know, certain and a lot in big swaths of the Toronto market and the Canadian market for a team that maybe represented them in a way that hockey teams didn't or baseball teams didn't. And I think Masai Ujiri was unafraid to speak to that. I think he was unafraid to, you know, acknowledge that some of these things are true. And I think he did it in a way that invited people to invited people in and helped them feel included, regardless of where any of them were from. And I think he was willing to use the incredibly powerful platform that the Raptors have, that professional sports have, to speak up for things he believed in, to do the right thing, to kind of send a message that, you know, it's okay to do the right thing and we should be doing the right thing. And I think that's not something you see with, you know, your average run-of-the-mill sports executive. It's not something that, you know, is often part of the mission for a lot of pro sports teams outside of, you know, the, I don't know, I can say the window dressing, but outside of, you know, the things that get done in a more routine way. I think it's going to be a long time before we see a pro sports team roll into, you know, the Disney bubble with buses, you know, wrapped in Black Lives Matter colors and all that kind of stuff. Like, it was a unique time. And I think Masai Ujiri lived really big. He dreamed really big. And he made room for a lot of people to believe those kinds of dreams could happen.
Last one for you, Grange. If you had to provide an educated guess, the next step for Masai, will it be basketball or beyond basketball?
I mean, it's hard for me to see him leaving basketball entirely behind. I know he's got ambitions to do all sorts of things. He's a guy who doesn't sell himself short. So there's politics. There's, you know, even bigger philanthropic goals. I know he's got huge interests of between that business and philanthropic goals in Africa that are like really vast in scope. So there's all that, but I think, you know, he still really burns around basketball. That's kind of his identity. It's in his blood. So I'd be surprised if he's not somehow affiliated. I think there is a possibility he ends up running another NBA team. You know, I do know he met with the Atlanta Hawks. I don't know if that's going to be something that ends up coming to fruition or not. But I think the safest bet is some of this stuff just gets pushed aside for a year, and he gets to kind of take a breath and figure out what the best place to put his feet are next.
Yeah, whatever's next for Masai Ujiri, there'll be Raptors fans tracking it and supporting it, that's for sure, because he gave a lot to this fan base and the city in 13 seasons with the team. Grange, we appreciate the time tonight. I know it's been a busy day. We'll chat again soon.
Thanks. Take care.
That's Michael Grange of Sportsnet.ca. He's been covering the decision from MLSE to let Masai Ujiri go after a immensely successful stint as the president and general manager previously of the team. Okay, just want to wrap up my thoughts on Tavares, because I left it, you know, talking about how, you know, signing this contract will forever cement his reputation as a positive, and it'll last well into a lucrative retirement. Frankly, you spend, it'll be 11 years at least with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and maybe there's not that much success. Maybe it doesn't yield a championship, but you've seen, if you've given that much to the team, the city and the organization is going to treat you well after. So he takes this deal, and maybe he doesn't win. Again, as I mentioned, maybe he's not actually a winner. This is a player who's only won three series now total. He's had some great moments, some series clinching moments, but this is not a guy who's necessarily had an immense amount of success when it matters the most. So maybe he's just not that guy, but he will go down now after 11 years, having given it best and given something at every stage, given something back at every stage along the way. 11 straight seasons, he could have made more money, but he wanted to play for the Maple Leafs. And for that, I like to make fun of his CRA battle. I'm retiring it. I will not say anything about the CRA battle with John Tavares ever again. That snark officially retired. So John Tavares takes the hometown discount. It's not something you see all that often, but kudos again to both the organization and the player for making it happen. Okay, the Toronto Blue Jays this weekend. 3-game set at Fenway Park. Tonight it'll be Jose Berríos versus Brian Bello. It'll be Chris Bassett and Eric Lauer over the weekend against Lucas Giolito and Walker Buehler, respectively. Vlad will not be in the starting lineup after being hit by Tanner Bibee. Is that changed, David Sis? You looked at me? Okay, so Vladdy is going to be in the lineup. Was not in the initial lineup. Thanks to David Sis for correcting me on that. It was initially reported that he would take some swings to see if he was ready to go, but no miss time for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. The Blue Jays were +105 dogs before Vladdy's surprise inclusion into the roster, so we'll see if that changes. But my best bet tonight will be kind of stolen from our next guest. He had a bunch of bold predictions, that being Cam Robinson, for round one of the NHL draft. And one was that there would be a run on goaltenders late in round one. And I found over 1.5 goaltenders in round one at +300. So I'm piggybacking on Cam Robinson, and I hope that he can make me even more confident with that pick when we have him on after the break. But just a reminder before we get to the break, UFC 317 goes down tomorrow night in Las Vegas. I believe it's International Fight Week, which always is a good time. I think Anna Dua is hanging out with Aaron Bronstetter down there, which is big time, of course. Huge main event. We've got Ilia Topuria and Charles Oliveira fighting for the lightweight title. Topuria just won the featherweight title. I think he defended it once. Now he moves up and he's taking on the former champ in Oliveira. Also a flyweight title fight between Alexander Pantoja and Kai Kara France. It'll be Royval and Van, Dariush and Moicano, and Peyton Talbot and Felipe Lima rounding out the main card. You can watch the prelims on Sportsnet 360 and order the pay-per-view on Sportsnet Plus. Okay, NHL draft is tonight. We are about 40 minutes away from Matthew Schaefer likely going first overall to the New York Islanders. Maybe the Islanders can get James Hagans too. It seems like that's more of a possibility after swinging a deal involving Noah Dobson today. We will break down that, ask the question of the goaltenders, and talk more about the NHL draft and the other things at stake tonight in the NHL world with Cam Robinson of Elite Prospects. That's next.
Covering the Blue Jays from an analytical perspective. Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back on the Fan pregame. Coverage of the NHL draft is begun. The NHL draft will begin at 7, but a little pregame show is up on Sportsnet as well. For Maple Leaf fans, or really any team that wanted to get in on the Sam Bennett sweepstakes potentially on July 1, well, there will be no sweepstakes. Sam Bennett, who won the Conn Smythe Trophy for himself and partly for us, will stick around in Florida. 8 years, $8 million per. So a big deal for Sam Bennett. Ends up making more than Carter Verhaeghe. I think that's a great deal for both the team and the player. Tax money aside, that's probably on the nose for a guy who plays really, really well in the playoffs and is a little bit limited offensively, at least during the regular season, which will now be 84 games, or at least soon be 84 games. So maybe he can make some inroads on a career high. It was our buddy Tim Reynolds, by the way, who reported it first. So shout out to Tim Reynolds of the AP. Cam Robinson is the content director and director of film scouting for Elite Prospects, and he joins me now from Los Angeles. Cam, you've been hyping up this event online. Is it still worth being hyped up, or is it still shaping up to be a wild one on the draft floor?
I mean, here's hoping, right? I mean, we've been kind of getting people excited year over year here, and oftentimes it doesn't turn out to be all that much, but something feels different, something in the air. And I think we've already started to see that, right? JJ Paterka went yesterday, Noah Dobson today. Utah, I'm told, is actively trying to get back into the top 10 here so they can get a shot at James Haggins. Their owner is pushing very, very hard. I was told from one source that he would do almost anything to get James Haggins. And I mean, for the jersey sales alone, it could probably make up for it. So I do think there's going to be some action. I think a lot of draft picks are on the table to be moved. I think we're going to see some fireworks.
Okay, let's talk about that Noah Dobson trade. We get a maximum term extension, a sign and trade. He goes to Montreal, making just short of $10 million. The 16th and 17th overall picks go back to the Islanders. For Matthew Darche taking over as Islanders GM president, why not build around Noah Dobson? What went into this decision to not give up on the player? I guess give up on the player, but move towards something a little more down the line in terms of timeline and not building around a guy who's, you know, ready to contribute at a high level right now.
I think it was, you know, several factors in it. And I think part of that is that, you know, Noah Dobson was looking for a big money contract and maybe bigger than what he ended up extending with Montreal. So we had heard that he kind of went in there and maybe he was looking for 10 or above. And it was maybe not a take it or leave it, but getting close to that range. And for the Islanders, they're a team that needs so many things. You know, their AHL affiliate was dreadful in Bridgeport this last year. They lack a lot of top end prospects. And so they're obviously going to get something here with Matthew Schaefer at the very top, if that's who they decide to go with. Getting those two picks, I think, was very, very important to them, especially because the plan is to hopefully get up again and draft James Haggins. And so I think this is just really telling on the evolution of this club and where they want to go. And they're trending towards being younger. And they got that done. And all it cost them was, you know, a number one right shot defenseman, which, you know, Columbus was right in it to the very end. I'm told they're very disappointed that they missed out on him. Those type of players just don't come to market very often, become available in trade. And so I know a lot of teams are interested in Dobson, but it came down to Columbus and Montreal. And I think Dobson had a hand in it being Montreal at the end, because I think that's where he wanted to be.
That's an interesting point. What does this give the Habs? Like, they got a lot of NHL ready defense, but Noah Dobson obviously ascends to the top of that list, or at least near the top of that list. Montreal's a talented team, got a lot of players, they have a lot of work to do to fancy themselves, I guess, as a competitor against a team like the Florida Panthers, just in terms of timeline. But this is a team that, you know, has continued to add, continues to impress, continues to add, you know, names that should change the fortunes of this team. How big of a boost does Dobson give them?
I don't think I can, you know, oversell just how impactful he can be. I know it seemed like he wore out his welcome a little bit on Long Island, but this is a highly talented player, a true, you know, a number one defenseman, someone who can put up a lot of points, someone who can play in all situations and chew up a lot of minutes for you. Like you said, he jumps right to the top of the pile on that Habs blue line. I know Lane Hutson is an extremely talented young player and offensively gifted, but to have both of those in your top four, to be able to spread out some of your offense and let, you know, Hutson kind of develop a little bit slower. Maybe he doesn't have to be thrust into chewing up 28 minutes a night all the time. I think it's massive for them, and it's going to help them take a really sizable step forward this year too. I think that they're not done. I think that they would like to continue to add potentially down the middle. But Montreal, like you said, they have a lot of young, talented assets that are continuing to grow and getting better. And this is a club that's going to be making noise in the short term. And I think for a lot of years too.
So the Islanders could have James Higgins. They have the first overall pick. So if they were really desperate to put on a jersey, I guess they could just make that decision. But it's likely that they don't do that. When ownership gets involved, though, you never know. But 16th and 17th pick, I don't think that quite will get you into the top four. Maybe it's possible. But is there a real opportunity? You mentioned shenanigans. A real opportunity for something crazy to happen, like, hey, a first-round pick and another star or former star of the New York Islanders? Like, how desperate do you think they will be? And is a team like Utah going to really take advantage here, maybe add another NHL-ready, another guy, like J.J. Paterka, like someone that even dwarfs J.J. Paterka in terms of impact, given the opportunity or given the desperation from the Islanders in order to add two key guys here at the top of the draft board?
Don't imagine it's going to be a player of that caliber like they brought in Paterka. I do believe that they're, you know, they're putting out there that 16th and 17th overall pick, but, you know, it, and I do believe it is Utah that is the number one target to move that pick out and for them to jump to four, is that Utah understands the situation that they're into, is that they hold kind of all the keys and all the power here. And so 16th and 17th, I don't imagine gets it done either. Whether that, and, you know, maybe it's Romanoff that's attached to it in some regard. Maybe a player comes back from Utah as well. I've heard the name Simon Holmstrom out there as well as potentially moving over. Both of those players, I think, make sense to lead the aisle. And I think that Utah would be interested in both of those guys. I'll say this too, is that last year we heard that Calgary tried every which way to move up from number 9 to number 6 last year to get Teej Iginla. And Utah owned that 6th overall pick, and they knew it. And Bill Armstrong just held steady. He said, we'll do it, but it's going to cost you. And that price was just too prohibitive for Calgary to go with. So I don't think that they're going to budge. And if the Islanders really and truly want to get James Higgins, they are going to have to overpay to get it done.
Utah continues to be in a position of power. We'll see how they see how they use it tonight. Okay, so we know what's going to happen at 1, likely. We expect something crazy might happen at 4, but that leaves 2 and 3. It seems it's like, between Michael Mesa and Anton Frondell is the decision here for San Jose. What do you expect to happen at 2?
I mean, I wish I had a ball here so I could throw it up and jump for it, because I do honestly believe it's a jump ball. I think nobody has, you know, held their cards closer to the vest than Mike Greer. If he wanted everybody to know that he's unpredictable leading up to the draft, he succeeded, because, you know, we've heard from viable, credible sources, you know, it was expected to be Michael Mesa. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, Anton Lundell started to leak out there. And often when that happens in days leading up to the draft, it's an organization prepping their fan base, because if everybody thinks it's going to be one player and then it's another, there's usually a pretty guttural reaction to something like that. So whether or not that was leaked out there on purpose or not, but now we're even hearing that number 2 is on the table, that they would consider moving that for a young roster player to take that step forward. It seems like everybody is very open to moving their picks and prospects right now. Everybody wants to get better. Everyone's looking for a hockey trade if possible, if they're moving one of their players. And nobody's really all that interested in taking futures, which diminishes all the draft picks. So a team like Vancouver has been trying to move the 15th overall pick for weeks to get themselves a second line center. And at this point now, they're just resigned to the fact that they're not going to make a bad deal, but instead they'll just have to make the pick if they have to. And so it's interesting in that regard.
So Islanders obviously want to do something, Utah and San Jose involved. Is there another team that you expect to do something tonight, whether it is for a draft pick, for a player, big game hunting? Is there another organization that you're hearing a lot of noise from?
The Columbus Blue Jackets. And so they were, like I mentioned before, they were right into the very end on Noah Dobson. They just pulled off and, you know, got Charlie Coyle, Miles Wood, but I don't think they're done. I think that they are searching for a right shot defenseman. I think they're searching for a defenseman in general. You know, I've heard Keandre Miller, which we know the Rangers have put to market and has put that out there to the league, that, you know, he's a name that I've heard floated out to Columbus. I think that they are looking to do something big. They have the 14th and 20th overall pick. I think that they have, you know, a guy like Voronkov could be a possible option that they could move and package up. They want to take a big step forward. Columbus is building something. They truly believe they're building something big here, and I don't think they're wrong. And so now is the time to, if you have to overpay in a trade or in free agency, if they want to go out and try to sign Mitch Marner to a massive contract, I think that that's kind of in their playbook right now, is that they want to make a splash. So I think we should be watching out for Columbus too.
We're talking to Cam Robinson live from the draft floor in Los Angeles. He's the contact director and director of film scouting at Elite Prospects. Are we all of our favorites, Cam? Is there a guy who you're going to get or irrationally excited for if they're picked in the top 5 or the top 10? Who's a prospect that you have a soft spot for that you're going to be excited for tonight?
I love Tayshaun Aitchison. So they call him Cash, and the kid's money in the bank. He is just this throwback knock 'em out player, a defenseman who hits hard, he fights hard, he scores big goals. 26 goals this year, 5 overtime winners from the blue line. Difficult to replicate year over year, but I know teams absolutely love this kid. His personality is magnetic. He's just a great human being, and I think he's going to be a fan favorite. And he wowed. He wowed at the combine. He impressed teams. I think that he's one that I expect will go higher than many do. And I think he's going to be a fan favorite. And so, yeah, I'm definitely rooting for him to slip into the top 10.
You have a bold predictions piece up at Elite Prospects that I was skimming through. And I noticed one of those predictions was no draft picks from the National Development Program in the United States, which it just like stunned, like stopped me in my tracks. Like, how is that possible? This is the organization that's been dominating this night on many occasions here in the last couple of years. Is there an explanation for that?
It's a down year. I think that's fair to say. It's a down year for that program anyways. And also some of the best American talents are the later birthdays, the 2006 birthdays. So James Haggins, you know, obviously he's going to go top 10. Logan Hensler, a quality defenseman. He went to the NCAA early as well. Shane Bensagi. So there's all these kids. And then, you know, a guy like Will Horkoff, who wasn't an older one. He's a 2007. He left the team partway through and went to Michigan and did better at Michigan. Colin Potter decided to skip playing for the program this year to go to Arizona State, and he had a really strong year too. So they lost a lot of their key players through no fault of their own in some regard, and then through a little bit of their fault. But it's just overall, it's just kind of a down year for that program. And to be honest with you, next year is also going to be a down year. But I'm told the 2009s coming up behind them, they're very excited about that class coming in. So I don't think it'll be too long a dip for the Americans.
Okay, we'll set our watch to that, 2009. Yeah. You're also predicting a run on first-round goalies, which is also something we don't normally see. A lot of U.S. national team guys drafted, not a lot of goaltenders. Could be the opposite way around. A run on goaltenders late in the first round. Why is that?
Yeah, and I will just remind the fans here these are bold predictions, but, I mean, they're based in some level of intel. So, part of it is the depth of this first round kind of collapses once you get to 2022. And so there are teams, and I know there are teams that have talked about it, is that instead of taking a player that they think is destined for, you know, a bottom six or a fourth line role or a bottom pair defenseman, is that why not take a cut on a goaltender who could potentially be a starter for you one day? And even though goaltenders don't hold much value on the trade market, having them in your system is very valuable. So there's Andrianov, the Russian, he performed really, really well at the Gold Star camp just earlier this month in Florida, and apparently really impressed the scouts. I had one team say that he jumped right to the top of their list for goaltenders. Semyon Frolov is another Russian goaltender who's had a lot of helium late. I've heard he could sneak into the first. And then Josh Ravensbergen has been the consensus number one goalie all draft class, expected that he would probably go at the tail end of the first round too. So there's a whole bunch of names there that I think we could see three goalies in potentially the last, you know, 5 or 10 picks.
You convinced me. Over 1.5 goaltenders in the first round is a bet for me tonight. The first round of the NHL draft. Bet responsibly. You also sat in on Gary Bettman and company talking about a new CBA. Not signed, sealed, and delivered yet, but all signs point to this being pretty much a done deal. A lot of details have been reported on that new CBA, which will come into effect for the 2026-27 season. What is your favorite detail? What do you like about the new CBA that the powers at B have ironed out?
Can I say the no dress code? Is that the beards are back on Long Island? I mean, no, Lou Lamoriello's gone there, so the beards are coming back anyways. But, you know, it's been rumored it wouldn't be confirmed, and I tried a couple of different ways to get Gary to spill the beans on some of the specifics of the CBA, and he even gave him credit. He's like, nice try again, but no, not going to share those details. But it sounds like it's, you know, being cap compliant on your roster in the playoffs is really intriguing to me. So it doesn't mean your entire team has to be cap compliant, but the ones you put on the ice for that game has to be under the cap. And I think that that's a really interesting new idea that they're putting in there. And, you know, we've seen teams every year now in the last 5 or 6 use that LTIR space, have a player like Mark Stone that sits out until the very first game of the playoffs, and then the cap, it doesn't exist. And so Nikita Kucherov a few years before that. And so we just see it year over year over year that these teams that are going deep into the playoffs, they're well over the cap if it was a regular season. So I think that's just something that bridges the gap in parity throughout the league, and it's something that we want to see. So I like that. I like the reduced preseason idea. Not sure I love 84 game schedule. I think the season's long enough as is, but I mean, it's a money-making machine. So, but it sounds like it was a pretty smooth negotiation, which is promising for fans that we won't have a lockout for at least 5 more years. And hopefully the friendship can continue with the PA and the owners.
Yeah, it's the best thing. You've given us international hockey. You're going to play hockey games. 84 is fine. Whatever. for the next 5 years. I will take that. Two more for you, Cam, before we let you go, because it will be a busy night. One on a former Islander and one on a future Islander. Let's start with the future Islander, Matthew Schaefer. He's the bell of the ball tonight. How good is this guy? Like, if you do the, I don't know if you play the comparison game, but if you're willing to, what is Matthew Schaefer going to be giving the Islanders for the next 10 to 15 years?
I'll play the comparison game. This kid reminds me of Miro Heiskanen. And if you want, we could say, you know, a left shot Drew Doughty. So he's that level of player. He's that level of mover. His skating is exceptional. He's not going to be probably like a Cale Makar or a Quinn Hughes. It's going to really shake and bake and dazzle and put up 80, 90 point seasons. But I think he's going to be a horse that, you know, can lead a team deep into a playoff run and chew up 26, 27 minutes a night and put up, you know, 50, 55 points every year. But the thing about him too, is that another one, I mentioned Keyshawn Aitchison, but Matthew Schaefer, the personality on this kid, the things that he's had to go through so early in life, and he persevered and he comes out of it with a smile on his face. When he broke his collarbone at the World Juniors, I ran into him in the bowels of the rink right after it happened. And I was like, broken? And he goes, yeah. And I was like, surgery? He's like, yeah. But he's like, sloughed it off. He's like, it's all good. I'll be back. And that was like moments after. And so just, he has this amazing perspective. He's such a competitor. I think he's going to be a fantastic player for the Islanders.
And the former Islander, John Tavares, taking a significant hometown discount with the Toronto Maple Leafs today. I don't think there's precedent for a 38-goal scorer taking 40% of what he's making the year before. How big of a deal is this for the Toronto Maple Leafs, who want to change the DNA but don't want to be without, you know, a second-line center or without any centers, given their situation and the lack thereof in free agency?
What a class act. What a class act to take that deal, because you're absolutely right. He left so much money on the table that he could have got in free agency. And I think that just proves, you know, the willingness and the desire that he has to win in Toronto, in his hometown. And so I know that he's taken some heat over the years in Toronto and on the Islanders, but he's a consummate pro. And I think that this is a great decision for the team, absolutely, and for him to finish his career in Toronto. And so he wants to win a championship there. And I think at the end of the day, it's like he's made enough money. He's willing to take a haircut on that to try to help the team win. And I hope the fans recognize that and support him through the rest of that career of his.
Hey, Cam, it's a lesser attended NHL draft, but it seems like it's worth the trip for you. So keep enjoying. Keep pumping out the great work. Enjoy tonight and the weekend, and we will chat again down the lines.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
That's Cam Robinson of Elite Prospects. Got a lot of great work up on that site covering this event tonight, and so will we on Sportsnet. The NHL Draft is coming up next on our network. Ailish Forfar, our very own, will be conducting interviews with the draft prospects, which is very, very exciting. But she is only one half of our expert team of prospect evaluators on the staff. The other would be our producer, David Siss, who has been responsible for curating the FPG Best Available. This is version 2.0, and he joins me now to discuss his big board, if you want to call it that. Are we willing to call it your big board, Dave?
Oh, it's a big board, all right. I mean, we got 16 players that we're going to go through here. So
we're going through. Well, you only have we got 7 minutes.
Maybe not all.
I mean, maybe we won't touch on all of them, but I'll let you. I'm not going to restrict you to, you know, 30 seconds on Schaefer. If you want to talk for 7 minutes on Schaefer, I will let you do that. I think we have the board to put up on the television. If you're watching at home, there is the FPG best available. I keep calling it best available. You got the 2025 draft big board, but either way, this is your curated list of your favorite prospects. And again, we got the Brampton Steelheads jersey up in the studio. You work for the Brampton Steelheads. You fancy yourself a draft expert in addition to Ailish Forfar. So this is not just blowing smoke here. This is real stuff. This is real evaluation. You have Matthew Schaefer one. You can extend on that if you want, but you know, the real decision is made at number two here with San Jose, and you've got Michael Misa going to San Jose at number two, or at least the number two prospect for you over Anton Frondell. I think we got the teams mixed up a little bit on that big board, but I digress. You like Misa over Frondell. Why?
Look, I've been watching Misa since he was an exceptional status candidate in the OHL or in the GTHL. And that is a kid who every time you watch him play, he proves you wrong, in the sense of every time someone ever thought, oh, he's a little too small, or, you know, he's not going to be able to play against bigger competition. Oh, he can. And he absolutely steals the show. He's probably, I project him to be more of a center at the NHL level. There was some debate over if he'd be better on the wing or down the middle, but I really see him as a center there. And he put up over 60 goals in the OHL this season. And that is not an easy thing to do. This guy can pretty much do it all. But one guy I really do want to talk about is Porter Marton. That's a kid who,
Okay, hold on. Well, before you get into your Martone, because this is a little conflict of interest. Porter Martone, of course, is a Brampton Steelhead. You are a Brampton Steelhead. Your number four Martone on your big board, is any of that because of your affiliation with Porter Martone?
I can safely say it is not. I mean, this is a kid who, again, another guy, ever since playing in the GTHL, he's been a game breaker. Even on his off nights, you will still look at the stat sheet after and see how the heck did he put up 3 points or just take over the game. And he's doing this when, you know, he could do that on an off night. And that just goes to show how good he is on his good nights. This is the guy who, when things aren't going well, he will get involved in the physical aspects of the game. He will take on anyone else in a fight if they say anything to one of his players. Like, this is a guy who just plays the game the right way. And now I do think, obviously, like any player in this draft class, there are still obviously things these kids have to work on. But this is a kid who sees the game arguably better than anyone in this draft class. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of things you can teach. There's a lot of things that players will, no matter how good you are, they're going to be trying to work on. But IQ is one of the things that, you know, that's, you either have it or you don't. And he definitely has it.
Okay. I'm surprised you're not at his draft party, but I digress. You like Misa, you like Martone, but you like Frondell more than Martone. And again, that's not, you know, don't Brampton Steelheads still wear the colors. What does Frondell project to be? What's he going to give the Chicago Blackhawks if they end up with him at number three?
Frondell is one of those players who, just like Victor Eklund, who was his line mate for a portion of the year too in Sweden this year. That's a guy who was playing all year with men. He had 29 games played, 25 points, I believe, in that span. And this is a guy who, another one, elite one-timer. He's going to be great on the power play. Playmaker, outstanding. The vision is there. There's nothing he can't do. He might not always look the biggest, but when he is, you know, taking checks from much bigger professional players, he keeps the puck on his stick with ease. He knows exactly where to be. He's going to create every time he's on the ice. He, along with Eklund, are two of the more NHL-ready players. They're both most likely not going to be in the NHL next season, but they probably have some of the more NHL-ready talent available.
Okay, so it's Schaefer, Misa, Frondell, Martone, James Hagans is number five on the FPG best available. If the top five are go that route, six for you is Caleb Desnoyers. A lot of people are high on him, and I want to ask you where you differ from others. So you got Desnoyers, Eklund, Brady Martin, Roger McQueen, Kayshon Acheson is your top 10. Is there someone in that 6 to 10 region that you're higher on than the consensus, or that you just really want to talk about in this precise moment?
Well, I don't want to copy Cam there with the Acheson comments there, but he's probably the guy that I'm most excited about. I think there is a chance we see him fall past that number 10 range, but that's a kid who, again, not only just a great person from everything you could watch any interviews with him, if you ever meet the kid, great guy, but it's more so the fact that the way he plays the game, he does a bit of everything, and he has so much confidence in himself. He's not the biggest guy in the world, but he is insanely physical. He has the clutch gene as well. He had quite a few game winners for a defenseman in the OHL, which is fairly rare, but he could put up points. He's only going to get better in that regard, but he plays a physical, mean game, the kinds of game that we just saw the Florida Panthers dominate at this year, or for the past 2 years.
This is why you write these reports. That's a good way to end off a report. You got me stumbling there. A little bit. Is there someone you think that can fall tonight? James Hagan's probably not going to be that guy because it looks like the Islanders will force the issue and not allow that to happen. But do you see someone maybe on your board that you're maybe higher on or whatever that could be waiting longer than expected tonight?
The one guy who I'd say there is a chance there might be Carter Bear, just because he had a bit of an injury. It shouldn't hold him back by all reports. He's ready to go. The kid put up 40 goals, 42 assists in 57 games this season. He wasn't on any draft boards this time last year. So this is a kid who's just throughout the entire year continued to get better. Not the biggest guy, but one of the biggest workhorses in the draft. So I hope, you know, maybe the size isn't there. Hopefully he's not the guy that falls there, because he really has the skill to be an elite player.
Look, sis, this is the type of performance that's going to get you on a flight with Eilish to the next NHL draft.
Oh, well, we'll see.
Or, I don't know, is there another Steelhead next year that'll be in the mix?
Oh, we got some good players coming up.
Good players? Okay. So you'll be maybe celebrating OHL championship in the near future as well. Okay, we appreciate it. The first inaugural edition, I guess, of the Fan Pregame Best Available Wraps with David Sis Big Board. We appreciate your contributions as always, assists. A reminder, the NHL draft is tonight on Sportsnet. On Sportsnet 1, the Blue Jays will be in Boston, the start of a three-game set with the Red Sox. It will be Jose Berríos and Brian Baio. Watch the NHL draft because the co-host of the Fan Pregame will be live from Los Angeles, Ailish Forfar, and the crew next on Sportsnet. We will chat with you next week.